Okay. So let us continue with the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on Mindfulness of Breathing here. And just to remind you, this is part of the Satipatthana, part of the four mindfulness meditations or four applications of mindfulness, which is the second set of these seven sets that make up the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, the aids to awakening here. So we're going to look at the remainder of this sutta and see, kind of see the whole process of Anapanasati, how it leads all the way to the experience of awakening itself. So yesterday we were looking at the contemplation of feelings, and the four steps here are equivalent to the Vedana Vipassana of the Satipatthana Sutta. And so we had a look at that, and now I'll just go through these steps in a little bit more detail to look at them individually to see how they kind of, how they are ideally, how these things are experienced. So the first step here is that you breathe in experiencing rapture, breathe out experiencing rapture. And the experience of rapture is really a kind of joy. It's a joy that can manifest physically, mentally, or often both. Yeah, it's kind of a mental and physical experience. You can feel like waves going through the body of kind of a pleasure, joy going through the body. And it often has a strong physical component, so it is fairly coarse compared to the later happinesses, but it is still very, very delightful when you start to get to this part of the practice. So one of the problems here can sometimes be to move, you're starting off by calming down the breath, which is the previous step, and now to experiencing the joy. So the question often is, how do you move from one to the other one? How can you make that transition in a sense? Because it is here, it's like a transition from just being peaceful to peace with a powerful sense of joy. There may already be some joy there, but now it's like you're making a bit more of a transition. And this is where sometimes you need to nudge the mind a little bit to help it to give rise to the joy. Sometimes the joy does not happen automatically. Sometimes you just stay with the breath, nothing really happens. At other times it happens all automatically. All you have to do is just wait and it just happens by itself. And if it doesn't happen automatically, you can try to use these little techniques that the Buddha talks about quite extensively in the suttas. This little nudging of the mind to remind yourself of something you have done in the past that gave you joy in the past. And just kind of bringing up that perception and then see if the joy comes as a consequence of that. You shouldn't be doing very much at this stage. There shouldn't be a very big effort of the mind or anything like that. If you make too much effort out of it, you tend to destroy the meditation altogether. It should just be a kind of giving rise to perception, a simple memory, without really thinking very much at all. Using that, then you bring that up, and then you bring that together with the breath, and then the two kind of work together. And after a while, the breath sustains that joy on its own, and you don't actually need to bring that object, that thing that gave rise to the joy, you can kind of let go of, and then the breath sustains it, and then you carry it on afterwards. So this is how you can give rise to that joy, and you can use anything, any kind of perception that you find useful. Just, you know, the idea of hanging out with your Kalyanamittas at Jhana Grove, and what a wonderful thing that is. And or anything like that which kind of has a positive feel to it and brings joy and happiness to the mind. That is kind of the idea here. And then you carry on your meditation. You're all the time now, you're staying with the breath. Yeah, this is all breath meditation. And as you do so, that what is previously pity, it calms down a little bit, it becomes less physical, and it becomes more peaceful. And then it turns into this second factor here, which is the sukha. The sukha is a more kind of deeper kind of happiness that is more peaceful and more profound. As you keep on moving along this path, there's two things that happens as you kind of deepen the breath meditation. The peace becomes more pronounced, it becomes more and more peaceful, and the happiness becomes more and more profound and deep and meaningful, and these kind of things, more powerful, if you like. So this is really the distinction between sukha and piti in the suttas, is the kind of the depth of the experience. One is much more tranquil, the other one is more physical and more kind of busy, if you like, has more movement to it. And as you come to the third step, as you keep on watching the breath, remember that you don't really need to do very much anymore at this stage. The further you come, you move on in this practice, the less you have to do, the less desire and want you have to have, the less will you need to put into it, the more you just stand back and allow the process to happen. It is largely dhammata, it is according to nature. This process starts to take over by itself. And then the next step then is the Chitta Sankarang Patti Sangvedi. Is that right? Yes, Chitta Sankarang Patti Sangvedi. And Chitta Sankarang is the experience of the movement or the motions of the mind. In other words, it's just another way of talking about feelings and perceptions, as I mentioned before. Just a continuation of the same process. And then the last one is when you calm down that even further. The feelings calm down even more, you become even more tranquil. Yes? And when you become more tranquil, it also makes the happiness more profound. So you can see here again, tranquility increasing, happiness increasing. These two are the kind of main themes of the movement of the mind as it moves into deeper stages of the anapanasati, of the mindfulness of breathing. These two going together. And again, it happens automatically. It happens automatically by just standing back. The more you stand back, the more this calming process happens by itself. So that is the second satipatthana in terms of mindfulness of feelings. Then we can turn to the third one. The third one being equivalent to the citta anupassana of the Satipatthana Sutta, the third Satipatthana, and again it has four factors in the Anapanasati Sutta, and this is how these four factors, what they sound like in the Sutta. He trains thus, I shall breathe in experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out experiencing the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe out gladdening the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, stilling the mind, immersing the mind perhaps. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, stilling the mind. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. And he trains thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. Mind here is citta, same word that you find in the third aspect of the Satipatthana Sutta. So this is equivalent to that. And it's specifically said to be, this is not just my interpretation, it's specifically said so later in the Anapanasati Sutta. So what does it mean to experience the mind? It may not be obvious what that means. And one way of understanding that is to think of a human being as having six senses, the five ordinary senses, and then the mind being the sixth one. And when you abandon the other five senses, what remains is the mind. That is how you can kind of figure out what is meant by the mind in this particular case. So what is happening at this stage in the meditation is that the other five senses are becoming very peripheral, very far away, very distant. Your meditation is becoming deeper. The deeper your meditation is, the less access you have to the other five senses. And you start to withdraw, like you withdraw into the mind. It seems like the other senses are far away. It's one of the experiences you can have at this particular stage. And this, at this particular point, this is very often where this thing we call the nimitta arises, like a bright light in the mind. You have all the joy and the happiness, and you take that joy and happiness a step further, and then you remove yourself from the senses to a very large extent, and the bright light of the mind comes up instead. And this is one way of thinking about the citta experience and the citta in this particular case, experiencing the light in meditation, like a bright, initially the light may not be very bright, but then after a while it becomes brighter and brighter until it can seem like the moon to start with, and maybe the sun, bright sun later on, etc. And this is what this light really is about. This is the citta experiencing the mind at this particular point. So again, this is one of the other transitions that you sometimes find in meditation. Yeah, you're not no longer just developing along a certain way. You're making the transition from the feelings to the mind itself, to seeing this light. And again, these transitions are often the things that are a little bit more, where you have to be a little bit more careful, because there is like a more major change than you have at the rest of the practice. So again, you have just have to be very gentle, you have to be careful. As you do this, you will often find the feelings in your mind, they calm down, they become very strong, all the sukha, the pity, and all of these things. And then very often, suddenly you start to see this light in the mind. It just appears as this process happens by itself. The question often is, well, at what point do you what do you focus on at this particular point? Do you focus on that light that arises? Do you stay with the breath? Do you stay with the feeling? What are you actually staying with? And in the previous section, there is the feelings and the breath like together. Yeah, you're focusing on the breath, but the feelings have become very pronounced. But there comes a point when the nimitta, the light in the mind, becomes quite strong. And only then do you normally change your attention, and you start to make that the main focus of your attention, this thing, this light in the mind. But it should be fairly stable before you do that. If you move too quickly, you find it disappears again also very quickly. It doesn't have the stability that is required. So make sure you build up a good foundation. When the foundation behind it is very strong, the feelings are very powerful and very tranquil, you have stayed with the breath for a long time, then the movement to the samadhi nimitta is appropriate. So that is how you do it. You have to kind of use your wisdom here. Otherwise, if you don't do it, you will again destroy the meditation that is happening here. So, again, these are just theory, when it comes to the practice, you will start to understand how this works out. And then, so you experience this light as you breathe in and you breathe out. The breath is now coming more and more into the background because the other aspects are becoming so much powerful. But the breath is probably still there, but it's kind of far away in the background somewhere. Then, what you do next here, it says that you, next one is, it trained us, I shall breathe in gladdening the mind. Yeah, and again, the idea is that when you start out, this nimitta, this light, in the suttas is called obasa, this light is initially perhaps not so strong, a bit dull perhaps, not very powerful in your mind. And as you stay with it, without doing anything in particular, it starts to brighten up just by how you focus on it. The good feelings are still there, but you want to make it even more happy, even more glad. Yeah, so it becomes very bright and very powerful. The more powerful it is, it means that the hindrances are dying down. The dull light means that there's still some hindrances in the mind that is keeping it dull. The more bright it is, the less hindrances you have in the mind. All the dullness, all the things that kind of stop the mind from being crystal clear and sharp and mindful, all of these things are gradually fading into the background just by staying with this. Sometimes people ask the question whether these nimittas are actually talked about in the suttas. I use the word nimitta, and this is a modern way of talking about these lights in the mind. In the suttas, the word nimitta actually means something else. In the suttas, it means the object of the meditation, like we saw the other day, the cemetery contemplations. This is called nimitta. In other words, it is the object or the subject that you use to allow the process of meditation to happen. So what about these kind of nimittas, the lights in the mind? And they are also talked about occasionally, but they have a different word used in the suttas. This word that is used is obasa and rupa. Rupa means like form, and obasa means a light, yeah, a splendor or a light. So what you see at this point in your mind's eye is like a light, but it also has a shape to it. So that's why it is form, and obasa is a very good description of what is going on. Rupa and obasa, light and form, that is essentially what remains in a mind at this particular point. So this, if you want to look it up, you can look at the Upakalesa Sutta, Majjhimanika 128. It talks about these lights and forms. And that is what is meant at this stage. There's also the word chittasa nimitta, which means like object of the mind. Yeah, and that also can refer to this light as well. You find that in a few places in the suttas. So, in particular, you find it in the simile of the cook, the famous simile of the cook. Actually, not that famous, it's just it's there, the simile of the cook, found in the Satipatthana Sutta, the 8th sutta, or the 9th sutta, I think, of the Satipatthana Sutta, simile of the cook. And it's the simile of the cook that makes all kind of nice food for his master. And then he is smart. He grasps the nimitta. He grasps the sign. He watches his master, sees what his master likes, and he makes the food accordingly, according to what the master likes. Yes, and it's a simile of the cook. In the same way, it's exactly the same way that you deal with the mind. You grasp the sign of the mind, which in that case might be the nimitta. And then you understand how the sign of the mind arises, etc. And then you practice accordingly. And it takes you into jhana states. That's what's specifically said in that sutta on the simile of the cook. Anyway, so you gladden the mind. And then as you keep on going, yeah, you're just training here, just means standing back, allowing things to happen, just by observing, becoming really, really ultra passive at this stage. Stilling the mind is the next one, samadhang chittang. The previous one was pamojahang chittang, I think. Samadhang chittang, stilling the mind. In other words, this nimitta becoming really, everything becoming extremely still, extremely bright, and for this reason very powerful, just by staying with it. And as you do all of this, there comes a point when the mind ultimately, finally becomes liberated, liberating the mind, the mochayang chittang. And what does this mean, to liberate the mind? It means that you are liberating it from first of all, you're liberating it from the 5 hindrances. The mind becomes fully purified at this particular point. And of course, that liberation is what what happens there is really the entry into deep samadhi, the entry into the jhana states. That is at that point that you know for sure that you have abandoned the 5 hindrances. Before that, it's very difficult to know fully, because you don't know exactly at what stage this nimitta is bright enough or clear enough. But once you enter the jhanas, you're absolutely crystal clear that you have given these things up. And this is often an experience that is like merging with a nimitta or something like that. Yeah, you merge with the sign, and that is like you fall into a state. It's an experience of a change in perception that happens at that particular point. So this is another place where the samadhi is like it. You have to be careful, because it is a quite a major change that happens at this particular stage. And this is where people sometimes get excited and realize something really interesting is about to happen, or they get sometimes they get a bit fearful because it seems so incredibly powerful these states. But after a while, you get used to it, and then you kind of attain these things, and then you realize it is only blissful and happy, and a tremendous benefit to be able to realize these things. So this is what happens here. Vimochayang, this word is related to the word vimutti in the suttas. And in the suttas, they distinguish between two kinds of vimuttis, liberation. One is what they call samaya vimutti, the vimutti which is like for an occasion or for a time. Yeah, it is a temporal kind of vimutti. And then there's the asamaya vimutti, which is beyond time. In other words, it is a permanent kind of liberation. And that is the liberation that comes from insight. But the liberation is similar, because both of those liberations, they destroy the opposing states, which are the hindrances and the defilements of the mind. Only that one is permanent and the other one is temporary. That's the only difference. But both are liberations. So this is the main kind of liberation at this point. The other kind of liberation that happens here is that you are liberated from the 5 senses. For the first time in your life, have you put the 5 senses behind you absolutely, completely, yeah, for a certain period of time, where you have no access to them anymore. And for the first time, you have actually left this whole Kama Dhatu, the Kama Vachara, what is called in the suttas, which is the realm of the five senses. You've left this completely behind, and all you have left is the realm of the mind, the Rupa Dhatu, it is called. It's actually called the form realm, but it really is the realm where the five ordinary senses have been left behind. This is why it's called the Lokanta, the end of the world, the end of the five senses. So for this reason, these things are extraordinarily powerful because they give you an insight into a different reality. You see something that you have never experienced before. The first time that you have become, you are now a frog. Yeah, this is one of the ways of looking at the liberation of mind. You become a frog at this particular point. Yeah, because you become that tadpole out of the water. You jump out of the water. Now you're no longer in the water, so you are a frog. And you have attained the stage of the frog. This is what they call the stage. Maybe we should write a sub-commentary about that. The stage of the frog. That sounds kind of... just to make it more interesting here. So now you're out of that one. For the first time in your life, are you capable of understanding what the sensual world is about? Fully capable of understanding that. And this, of course, is why these experiences carry with them the potential for tremendous insight, because you have the data that you don't get unless you actually achieve these things. Suddenly you know fully through your own experience the limitations, the impermanence, and the non-self nature of the entire sensual world, or I should say sensory world is a better way of putting it. So that is taking the mindfulness of breathing all the way to deep samadhi. This is really incredibly powerful stuff. And you can see the amount of happiness and joy and stillness, this one level after the other, increasing all the way till you have the vimocha and chittang. It's an extraordinary path. And sometimes when people say that Buddhism is pessimistic, it's all about suffering, it's because they haven't got a clue what's in these suttas. Once you start to get a clue what's in it, you think, wow, I want to allow my whole life to revolve around this, because this is truly meaningful, truly powerful, truly giving of a true aim and goal and purpose in life. So it's very important to remember the positive side of these suttas. Okay, let's come to the last part of the sutta. Now we come to the part which has to do with insight specifically. So this is equivalent to the Dhamma Nupassana, the contemplation of principles or perhaps mental qualities, is the very last one here, equivalent to the last part of Satipatthana Sutta. And this is how it reads in the Anapanasati Sutta. It trains thus, I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence, anicca. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away, viraga. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating cessation, nirodha. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating cessation. He trains thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment, patinissaga. He trains thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment, patinissaga. So, that is the insight thing. What are these four things? There's four things here that are being contemplated. Anicca, viraga, nirodha, and patinissaga. What are these four things? And they are just different degrees of impermanence, different degrees of anicca. Anicca, all of them are kind types of anicca, but they are anicca in different guises, in different ways. The very first one, anicca, is just the fact that things are changeable and unreliable and uncertain. That's the very first one there. The idea of anicca, sometimes we translate it as impermanence. Sometimes that may not be the best kind of translation. One of the things that Ajahn Brahm always taught me when I was learning Pali with Ajahn Brahm, he said that one of the nice things about the Vinaya Pitaka, very often there you find the words used in their natural meaning. So they're very easy to understand. when words are used in the suttas, they are used in with a specialist spiritual vocabulary, and it can be quite hard to really fathom what they are supposed to mean. But when you see words in a natural meaning, you get a very good grounding for what these words actually refer to. And in the Vinaya, the word nitcha is the opposite of anicca. Nitcha does not mean permanent. You have the nitcha bhatta. Bhatta means meal in Pali. It can mean rice or meal. And nitcha bhatta does not mean a permanent meal. Yeah, you can't, because you can't have a permanent meal. You get invited to a nitcha bhatta, it means you get invited to a regular meal. Yeah, you go on a regular basis to a house, and then you have a nitcha bhatta. It doesn't mean you're sitting in the house eating all the time. That would that's just too much. So it is a regular meal. So anicca means irregular. It means something that is unreliable, something that does not happen regularly. It is unreliable. It is out of control. It is things that will let you down eventually. That is the idea of anicca. Something that is changing. You cannot rely on it being there. And it is a bit like the waves on the ocean. Yeah, the waves coming and going, changing all the time. And this is kind of the idea of anicca. But anicca has deeper aspects to it, and one of the deeper aspects is the idea of viraga. The word viraga has two meanings in Pali. On the one hand, it means like non-desire, the opposite of desire, the giving up of desire. But the other thing, which is just as important, is the idea of fading away, things gradually diminishing. So this refers to a particular kind of anicca, a particular way of being impermanent. And it's a direction of the impermanence. It's a direction towards something gradually disappearing and fading away. Yeah, fading away means something becoming less and less and less. And you see that in your meditation. You see things fading away. Yeah, the world outside gradually diminishing, fading away. The body kind of gradually disappearing. This is what it means. And of course, that fading away, eventually it leads you to the ending of things. If the fading away, if you take that to its limit, eventually it ceases. And this is the next one here, is Nirodha, things coming to an end. Gradually fading away and eventually ceasing completely. Yeah, it's a very powerful moment, because when things cease completely, you get a very deep understanding of the nature of that phenomenon. And then, as a consequence of that fading away and ceasing, eventually you relinquish these things. You no longer have any desire for them. If you see things again and again ceasing, completely disappearing, and you gain insight into them, because when something ceases, you see very clearly that it is suffering. You see it suffering, because when it's gone, you feel much better. You know it was suffering. You see that it is absolutely impermanent. You know that it is non-self, because when something has ceased and you cannot access it at all anymore, and this is one of the things about the vimochayang, chittang, the liberating the mind, the fact that you enter into a different reality. This is what's going on here, a different state. It means that you no longer have access to the previous reality you were in. You have entered a different realm, so to speak. You cannot access the other realm as long as you are in that realm. So as long as you are in a jhana state, you have no access to many of these things. If you have no access to them, by definition, they are non-self. You start to understand the meaning of anatta in Buddhism. Keep on doing that long enough, it's dukkha, it's non-self. Eventually, it clicks, you get it, the penny drops, that there's no need, there's no purpose having any craving or desire for this, because all you are craving for is dukkha. You can't crave for dukkha. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. It's like, craving to have pains and craving to have problems. If you know what's going on, you don't crave those things. So eventually, you let it go completely. You have no more desire. Craving stops completely. Pati nisaga. This is kind of the highest kind of impermanency. When you give it up, give up attachments and desire for these things. So this is the sequence. So what exactly is it that has these qualities of cessation and fading away? What is it? And what it is that sequence that you have just been through. You have just been practicing a sequence of 12 steps, or perhaps you haven't done the whole sequence, perhaps you've done only a few steps of the sequence, perhaps you've only come to the nice feelings, or perhaps you only come to the peaceful breath. It doesn't matter. You have done a certain a certain sequence of these steps. Ideally, you go through all 12 because that gives you far more information to understand how to do the, becomes much more powerful to do the inside practice afterwards. But it doesn't have to be all 12 steps. You can get a little bit of insight just from looking at a certain number of steps. So you look back at what has been happening here. And what has been happening? Well, what has been happening is that there has been a large number of things that have been gradually disappearing in your mind, gradually fading away, and ideally, eventually disappearing completely. What are those things? Well, the body. Yeah, it doesn't take long. A little bit of meditation, the body starts to fade away. You don't feel the body so much anymore. The body starts to become calm, become settled down. It starts to become insignificant, gradually fading away until eventually it ceases completely. Five senses, a similar kind of thing. The five senses are then refined down eventually just to be with the breath. All we have left of the senses is the breath. Everything else is gone. And then the breath also starts to disappear. All we have the nimitta. And eventually the five senses cease completely. This is part of the Rupa Loka. So this is the first, like equivalent roughly to the first of the five khandhas that is actually ceasing here. Another thing that ceases in this process, gradually fades away, is your will. All the activity that you have, things are becoming more and more peaceful. The will is going more and more into the background. There's less and less sankhara. The sankharas are calming down. This is the fourth of the five aggregates, becoming more and more peaceful until you enter the jhana state and it's all gone. All will has disappeared. You are locked into a state. There's nothing you can do. And all you have is this very joyful and happy experience. Very happy to have given up all will and desire, all that kind of thing. So you see the gradual fading away of the will. And what a wonderful thing it is. One of the really nice things is to notice as you practice this path how nice it is to give up some of these things. As things disappear, it just feels so good. And especially the will, it is very useful to notice that, because the will, we are so attached to the idea of being the agents in our life. And the more you understand the beauty and the liberation, the freedom that arises from giving up the will, the easier it is to actually carry out this process and to keep on doing it again in the future. So notice these things as you do this. Same thing with the body and the five senses. Notice the dukkha that is there when it is around, and the liberation that comes from putting these things behind you. Here what you're doing, you're seeing the three characteristics in these things. Same thing is true of Vedana, feelings. As you go through this process, gradually certain feelings cease, gradually all the painful feelings cease, certain types of happy feelings disappear, the piti becomes less pronounced, the sukha becomes more pronounced, everything becomes more refined as you move along. You can see that certain feelings disappear. And it's, again, the same kind of process that you are noticing as you do this. Perception. Perception is the way we just the experience we have of reality at any particular time. What you are experiencing at that time. It includes everything in your mental experience. That is also changing all the time, becoming more refined, becoming more unified, becoming less and less and less in your perception, until the perception eventually unifies in one point, and all you have is one single experience lasting for a very long period of time. Consciousness, consciousness is becoming more and more narrow until eventually you have only one type of consciousness left, the mind consciousness. The other consciousnesses have gradually faded away and eventually ceased. So this is what you're seeing. You're seeing this, your experience, Your experience is moving towards less and less, towards more and more peace, towards more and more happiness. Your entire world view is gradually shifting in this way. Certain things are disappearing, fading away through this process. And what is it that actually is fading away? Well, I've just kind of pointed it out. What it is the five khandhas. This is actually what you're experiencing, is the five personality factors, often called the five aggregates, but I don't really like the word aggregate. Sounds like a pile of sand or something. we kind of order aggregate for our monastery, and I think this is very different from what's in the sutras. Anyway, so five personality factors. This is what it is, yeah? Some people often ask, I've been asked so many times, about what are these five aggregates? And I say, well, they are, you know, rupa, vedana, sanya. Yeah, but what are they? This is what they are. This is it's your direct experience in meditation practice and seeing them fade away in this way. This is how you gain insight into the five aggregates. In many suttas, it just says that, you know, it lists the five aggregates and it says this is how they are, this is how they arise, this is how they pass away, and you gain insight into this. But it doesn't really explain how you do it. It sounds like it is some kind of mental game you play with yourself. Yeah, it's arising and passing away, it's happening this way and that way. But actually, this is how you experience these five aggregates, their cessation, their gradual movement away, and how you ultimately gain insight into these things. So now hopefully you have some appreciation of why deep samadhi is so incredibly useful, why the jhana states in particular are so extraordinarily useful, because when you enter the jhana states, so many of these things have ceased completely and you no longer have access to them. That means that you have a full understanding of their impermanence. You know what they are. You have a full understanding into their suffering, because now you feel much more happy without them. Yeah, so you fully understand what the suffering is about. And you also have a full understanding of the non-self nature, or at least of some of these aggregates. Not everyone yet, but at least some of them. So this is why the connection between insight and samadhi is so incredibly powerful, because you have the data which makes it possible to understand what is going on. That is why it is useful. It's useful for many other reasons as well. The mind is very powerful, the mind is very stable, it has the ability to give rise to very profound mindfulness and all these kind of things. So there's heaps of advantages with deep samadhi. The deeper it is, the more powerful it is going to be and helpful to carry you through with these things. So there you are. That is then equivalent to the last of the Satipatthanas, which is the Dhamma Nupassana in the Satipatthana Sutta. And just to briefly maybe mention the Dhamma Nupassana in the Satipatthana Sutta, as I said the other day, that Dhamma Nupassana is a very broad category in the Satipatthana Sutta, but there's only two of those contemplations that really are important in there, as far as I'm concerned. And the two most important ones by far is the five hindrances and the seven awakening factors. And if you do, as I mentioned before, a comparative study of the suttas, these are the two sets that are the most important one, because they are found across the board in all the various versions of Satipatthana Sutta. So these are the places you should focus on. And it makes very good sense when you understand the place of Satipatthana in the overall scheme of the gradual training. Satipatthana is between the right effort and samadhi. So Satipatthana is always the thing that takes you to samadhi. And of course, to take you all the way to samadhi, the very last thing you need to do is you need to fully understand the hindrances, because they are what stop you from entering samadhi, and you need to develop the bodhjhanas, the awakening factors, because these are the factors that ultimately also lead you to samadhi. So it makes very good sense that we should investigate these things, and as you investigate them, you actually, that is how samadhi comes about. So when you read the Satipatthana Sutta, it specifically says in there that you know each of the hindrances, you know what it is, you have a full understanding of the hindrance. Yeah, this is often quite hard, because these are very deep-seated things. As I mentioned before, you may be doing your meditation practice, you come to a plateau, it doesn't take you any further. Why is that? Because you have some sort of attachment or some sort of desire that is very deep-seated. You can't even see it, you don't even know it's there. And then you have to uncover that, you have to find out what the problem is and then take you further. So this is why the uncovery of these hindrances, just knowing what they are, is very useful. Then understanding what drives them, what is it that keeps these hindrances in place? And what keeps them in place, especially when it comes to the five, especially when it comes to kama chanda, the attachment to the sensory world, what keeps it there is seeing the beauty of that five sense world. As long as you think there is something to be had in that five sense world, as long as you think that there is some positive experience to be had there, you won't be able to let go of it. You will have some kind of attachment there. So you understand that, and when you understand that, then you understand also what the answer is to the problem, and the answer is to understand the disadvantage in that five sense world, understand that it isn't really as good as it's made out to be, and then you can gradually let go of it, because you lose your interest. You don't have that subha nimitta. Subha means beauty. Nimitta is again the aspect of beauty, so you don't focus on the aspect of the beauty in that world anymore, and then you let go of that gradually, and then you gain something far better instead. This is one of the problems. Sometimes people will say that they want to enjoy both the meditation practice and the sensory world because they're not ready to let go of the sensory world. They want to have both. Yeah, why should I give up any kind of happiness? I will have all kinds of happiness. Yeah, the problem with that is that actually that happiness in the sensory world blocks you from achieving something better. So you have the choice. You can have inferior happiness or superior happiness. And so what are you going to choose? Yeah, so it obviously makes sense to go for the superior happiness. Why choose something inferior if you can have something better? And this is really the point here. Sometimes you cannot have both. Sometimes you have to give up something lower to be able to achieve something higher. Yeah, you can... Anyway, so that is what you can... This is kind of the idea here. So you understand the causes, you let go of the causes for that sensual desire, and then you get out of it. And this is how you do that, and then you also avoid the causes in the future, because you have understood what they are like, you avoid them in the future by practicing samadhi, etc., and then you understand these five hindrances in this way. This is how you kind of uncover these five hindrances. Same thing with the ill will hindrance, the viapada, exactly the same principle. You want to understand it in its full scope. You understand the cause of viapada. What is the cause of viapada? It is seeing something that is hard to bear, something that is repulsive, or not repulsive perhaps, but patigga is the Pali word, something that is you resist, yeah? You resist it. It's something that you don't like. It's a resistance inside of you towards that. And then if that keeps on coming to you, when you try to resist it, eventually it can give rise to ill will. It is something that is unpleasant. So you understand that. So you see that whenever you are resistant to something, something is unpleasant, what you have to do is change your attitude to the object. That is by far the most powerful way of overcoming ill will. So resistance and seeing the negative very often happens to people. So you learn to look at the people you have ill will towards. You learn to look at them in a different way that doesn't give rise to that ill will. And it's not that hard to do. This is the surprising thing. People often think these things sound very difficult, but actually it's a trick of perception. I'll talk more about this later on, how to deal with that. And they're very, very powerful. Anyone who takes these things seriously and really uses it with commitment and perseverance will be able to let go of the vast majority of ill will. Maybe not completely, because completely takes a very high level of meditation, etc., but at least the vast majority you can let go of. And the same thing is true for the other of the five hindrances. First of all, actually I'm going through the five hindrances in detail. We're going to leave that for later on, but anyway, we can maybe do it twice, because there's always a scope for looking at these things in detail. Then you have the three last hindrances. How do they arise? And the way that they arise is because sloth and torpor, or drowsiness and dullness, as it is a better translation. How does that arise? Because you enjoy the dullness and drowsiness. Yeah, as long as you think it's nice and pleasant, your mind will go there. But when you understand that all you're doing is kind of blotting things out, you don't want to have any, you know, you just don't want to be here because too much dukkha or whatever. Dullness and drowsiness is very often a reflex that comes from dukkha. So you're going to dull out the mind. Then you understand, actually, it is only a problem because it destroys your ability to see things clearly and to bring your meditation forward and to have some insight into what is going on. So you understand the problem with that. Understand the problem? You withdraw from it. Restlessness and remorse, similar kind of thing. You enjoy the restlessness. Yeah, it may seem strange, but actually we enjoy restlessness very often. And this again has to do with our attachment to the doer, to doing, identifying with the doing. As long as you identify with doing, it means that you will enjoy craving too. Because craving drives the doing. So you think, yay, craving, now I can do something, I can run after these things I crave. Yeah, craving is good. I am craving. You identify with craving itself. Yeah, this is me. I'm the craver. I'm the desirer who desires things in the world. And I run after all these objects to satisfy my desire. And you satisfy, you are the craver and you are the doer that is runs after those things. And you feel alive because you are satisfying this need to exert the doer inside. You're exerting your sense of identity. That's what's going on. And because you're exerting your sense of identity, you feel alive. You feel real. So many people like that in the world. We all are like that to some extent. But some people are real doers. They thrive on doing. The maximum they can do. They feel alive and they feel, yay, I'm alive. And they don't understand that actually they're torturing themselves. Why? Because all the doing is actually quite painful compared to being completely peaceful. And this is why it is so useful to remember this as you practice the path, to look at the peace of meditation, to understand how delightful it is compared to the doing. And then you undermine that sense of self, which is the doer inside. Very useful thing to do, because these things are very deep-seated. So in this way, you get away from the hindrance of restlessness. And the last one is the hindrance of doubt. Keep on studying the suttas, listen to wise teachings, understand what is going on, and then after a while your doubt about what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, that is specifically what this is about, will start to disappear, and it becomes clear to you. And also through your investigation of your meditation, the same thing will happen. So this is parallel to the thing we have just been looking at now. The reason why these are parallel is because through the investigation of the five hindrances, you understand their impermanence, you understand how they fade away and cease, which is exactly what we're talking about here. Yeah. So one of the main themes or things that we are focusing on here is the fading away and cessation of the five hindrances. This is one of the main themes, because that is what will enable you to gain samadhi regularly later on if you understand how to overcome these things. But then there is also the opposite, and that is the seven factors of awakening itself. Yeah, you practice the seven factors of awakening, and you understand the seven factors of awakening in exactly the same way. You understand what causes these seven factors of awakening. You understand what they are, first of all, what causes them, and how they come to maturity and development through the practice. And this is also to do with thing here, the anicca in particular, the impermanence, and how they develop, and how they are the inverse of the five hindrances. You overcome the five hindrances, and then the seven factors of awakening arise out of that. The phoenix that arises out of the ashes of the hindrances. Something like that, anyway. So this is the Anapanasati Sutta, and how it relates to the four Satipatthanas, and how really you can fulfill all those four Satipatthanas, the seven awakening factors, and it takes you all the way to awakening by watching the breath, if you do watch the breath skillfully here. So that is why the Buddha says at the very end here, "Bhikkhus, everyone, that is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, so that it is of great fruit and great benefit." So As you can see here, and I think this is an important point of the Anapanasati Sutta and also of Satipatthana, as you can see from all of this, is that these things are about two things. They are about both Samatha and Vipassana. Sometimes in the Buddhist world, we distinguish between Samatha meditation on the one hand and Vipassana meditation on the other, as if these are two separate things. Very often the breath meditation is called Samatha meditation, and Satipatthana is often called Vipassana meditation, as if these things can be neatly categorized in these ways. But actually, that's not really how things work in the suttas. As I have mentioned already, in the suttas, everywhere where you look, where you see Satipatthana in context, the context is always that Satipatthana leads to Samadhi. If it leads to Samadhi, it must have be Samatha, at least in part. If there's no Samatha there, how can it lead to Samadhi? On the other hand, there's also always a Vipassana component, because you always have to contemplate these things in the right way to enable you to make progress, to understand the hindrances, to understand what is going on, to allow you to achieve that Samadhi. So both Anapanasati, in fact any kind of meditation that you do, has both a Samatha component and a Vipassana component. And the Samatha component is simply the calm of the mind that you have. The Vipassana component is the clarity that you have, the clear seeing. In other words, the ability to see these characteristics of impermanence and dukkha. The more peaceful you are, the more clarity you have, the more things clearly you can see things. The more clarity you have, the more clear seeing you have, the more Samatha you have. These things always have to go together. They are part and parcel of the same process that happens through the meditation practice. You can't distinguish these things from each other. And in the suttas, you very often see this. You see the idea, instead of talking about Samatha and Vipassana as separate things, very often they're talked about as a compound. Compound Samatha Vipassana. Two aspects of the mind, two complementary aspects that are developed together on the Buddhist path. And I think this is a very important thing to remember, because it takes away so much of this kind of clash that you might hear about in the Buddhist circles about whether you should practice Vipassana or Samatha. Actually, it's a really false distinction. We don't even need to think about the Buddhist meditation like that at all. If you practice in the right way, it should always lead to both of these things. Why is that? And the reason why that is the case is because the cause of Samatha is exactly the same thing that also causes Vipassana. The thing that leads to Samatha is always a reduction in the defilements of the mind. When the less defilements you have in the mind, the more peaceful you're going to be, the more Samatha you're going to have. Why is that? Because the defilements are the things that always take you out of the present moment. The defilements that will take you into the past and the future. The defilements are the restlessness. The defilements are all of these things that stop the mind from being peaceful. So the less defilements you have, the more peaceful the mind is going to be. But it's exactly the same thing for Vipassana. This is what is so interesting about it. The thing that stops you from having Vipassana, from seeing things according to reality, is exactly the same defilements. If you have sensory desire, a desire for the objects of the sensory world, you have a vested interest in those things, you won't be able to see them clearly, because you have a vested interest. You can't see things clearly that you have a vested interest in. You see it with a desire, you see it with a view to get something out of it, rather than seeing it as it actually is, in an unbiased way. You can't see it in an unbiased way. Same thing with ill will, there's a vested interest there. So the less defilements you have in the mind, the more Vipassana you have, the more clear seeing you have. So Samatha and Vipassana come from the same root, the same source. The source is a reduction in defilements. Now the whole purpose of Satipatthana and right effort and all of these things is to reduce your defilements. That's the whole point. This is why we do all of these things. We learn about the five hindrances. You learn about giving up, using the contemplation of the 31 parts of the body to reduce your attachments and all these things. The whole process is one of reduction in defilements. And because it is a reduction in defilements, it gives rise to these two things, Samatha and Vipassana, all the way along. And you cannot distinguish between the two. They always have to go together. And where does it go? It leads to samadhi. What is samadhi? It is both samatha and vipassana. If you get a deep state of samadhi, you're going to have a lot of clarity afterwards. You're going to understand what is going on. That too is part of that same process. And that is why in the suttas you always have the connection between samadhi and yathabhuta and anadasana is so common. You see this throughout the suttas. After samadhi, you see things according to reality. Again, it is because of this connection between samatha and vipassana. Yeah, they always hang out together. The deeper the samatha is, the deeper the vipassana is going to be, and vice versa. Always building each other up in that way. So, that is a little bit about samatha and vipassana for you. I think because these things are what we are doing here and now, and I think it is important to understand how these things are taught in the suttas. And I think it's kind of nice to let go of some of these kind of discussions that we have in the Buddhist world, whether samatha is right or vipassana is right. Well, really, if you look at any meditation system that works, and all these meditation systems that you find around the world, they can work if they are used in the appropriate way. None of them is probably wrong. Yeah, they all kind of can work, but they should always look at them from these two perspectives, samatha and vipassana. And those people who do vipassana meditation, actually, if you look at what they're doing, there's a lot of samatha involved in that as well. Yeah, and those who do samatha meditation, there's always a lot of vipassana involved in that as well. And then you start to kind of look at these things and you start to say, well, actually, what matters is that you're making progress. What matters is that you're actually giving rise to the good qualities of meditation. What matters is that in the long run, your mind is becoming purified and you're actually heading in the right direction. If you are doing that, then whatever meditation you're doing is okay, and there is no problem, and we can get rid of some of these arguments that we have sometimes in the Buddhist world. So, there you are. So that's the beautiful Anapanasati Sutta, and how it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness, and foundations of mindfulness, I apologize. I promised never to say that, for applications of mindfulness. That is all about that. And we have now completed really as far as I wanted to go with the second of these four categories as part of the 37 Bodhipakkhadhammas. And this afternoon, when we come back again at 3 o'clock, we can go on to the next set, which is the Iddhipadas. And we're going to have a look at that fairly quickly, because there isn't that much to say about these things. So we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock this afternoon.